You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. This weekend marked the one-year anniversary of a dark time in Boise. Police say 30-year-old Timmy Kinner went to a birthday party on State Street last June 30th and allegedly attacked nine people with a knife. The three-year-old birthday girl was killed. Eight other people were injured, all of them refugees. 2 days after that, Boise Police Chief Bill Bones was still shaken by what he had seen right after that attack.
Walking through the aftermath of the scene and seeing the children's faces and the victims' faces at the hospital, those are things that are just indelibly carved on your heart. So for the first responders that walked in there and for everybody that's a part of that, and really for our very community, it is something that has become part of our psyche at this point in time and something that I would think will continue. But that also, it offers us an opportunity to learn and to move forward and to reaffirm who we are, mm-hmm. to, you know, reinstitute and show locally and across the country who Idahoans are.
And today, we think it's important to look back at what happened, but to also look ahead to the future. Our reporter, James Dawson, has this update 1 year later.
It was a perfect sunny summer day last year when this quiet apartment complex off of State Street would become one of Boise's most gruesome crime scenes.
People were scattered across the apartment complex, both within apartments themselves, lying in the street, and in the walkways.
That's Boise Police Chief Bill Bones describing the scene at a news conference the following day. A 30-year-old homeless man named Timmy Kinner had been staying with someone at the complex that week, prosecutors say, but he was eventually kicked out. The next day, he slashed his way through a child's birthday party, according to police. The 3-year-old birthday girl, Ruya Kadir, was dressed as a Disney princess, surrounded by friends. She later died from her wounds, while 8 other children and adults were treated at local hospitals.
This was a brutal crime, not just against the individuals involved, but against the families and the very fabric of our community.
Ruya's mother, Beefy Two, has since sued the owner and property manager of the apartment complex, Kinner, and the person who let him stay there. That suit is ongoing, as is the criminal case against Kinner. He's been deemed mentally unfit to stand trial, for now. In April, a judge issued a gag order forbidding any potential witness in the case from talking to the media.
I got a call from family and friends and mentioning that there was an attack.
Al Waleed Abdullah wasn't at the Wiley Lane apartment complex that evening. He works 2 night shift jobs. One is a caregiver and another is a supervisor for a local janitorial company. His family and friends told him fellow Iraqi refugees got hurt in the attack. Abdullah escaped violence in Baghdad, where his aunt was murdered.
I felt really shocked because we didn't expect such a thing to happen in Boise. Consider Boise is very safe.
When he left work the next morning, Abdullah took flowers to a makeshift memorial near the scene. All of this happened just 2 days before he and his now wife Fatima Aboud were supposed to get married. They postponed the wedding for a couple months out of respect for their friends recovering in the hospital. Aboud says it took her a while to feel safe again, but these last few weeks have had her on edge. At night, she hears noises that trigger a panic, and she calls her husband at work.
I have to keep all the doors shut, and even when it's shut, like, I don't feel safe here. Like, I feel like someone's going to come and do something.
Aboud says other members of the refugee community were worried about things others take for granted.
They felt, like, really scared to go to the car and drive their car to work. So they let, like, their daughter or son watch them go in the car and leave.
Some got to the point where they thought about moving away from the city entirely.
They, like, wanted to. They were thinking of Boise is not safe anymore, and stay
angry maybe or something or sad, and you know, but with time they know they couldn't find a better place than Boise, you know.
Support groups responded immediately to the stabbing. Tamara Venegas oversees Boise School District's Counseling and Social Work Division.
Many of those students were in summer school, so they did have access to school counselors and school social workers both. And then the refugee agency set up private individual counseling for the families and the children.
A groundswell of local donations followed. The International Rescue Committee raised more than $445,000 in the months after the attack. About a third of that has been spent so far on living expenses for the victims and adapting a new home for a family living with lingering physical problems. The rest of the fund will be doled out based on the extent of injuries they suffered. A group of tax and trust lawyers are donating their time pro bono to help. In the meantime, the refugee community and Boise at large will be remembering Ruya, as they did at the memorial, the little girl who loved pink and purple flowers.
Her name in Turkish means dream. And she came to us like a dream, and she left as quickly as a dream.
James Dawson, Boise State Public Radio News.
And our James Dawson is joining us live in studio now. So, James, you actually covered this story from basically the moment it happened. So take us back to how and when you started covering this.
Sure. So I remember it was a pretty warm Saturday night. It was, you know, kind of that picturesque time in June where it's not too hot, but still warm enough to be outside. I actually lived not too far away from that complex at the time. And I remember just this continuous stream of sirens screaming by. And that's, you know, not something you usually hear in Boise. So I wasn't able to make it to the scene until the next morning. I was kind of concerned that I wouldn't be able to make it in and out of the scene.
Right.
So I followed it a lot online, filed stories, but went out the next morning pretty quickly. And from pictures and people that I talked to, the scene was pretty chaotic the night before. Like I said, got there the next morning. Firefighters were still spraying blood off the concrete there, cleaning up the crime scene. Talked to people who brought flowers to a makeshift memorial that was kind of set up there over the canal, signs, flowers, even a little card hoping that the people in the hospital would get better quickly. The people that I talked to, they told me they felt like they just needed something to do, an outlet to really show their support for the refugee community.
So you, as we said, you've been following this story ever since because it's taken some turns with the crime itself. So let's talk a little bit about that, because police and prosecutors charged Timmy Kinner with the attack. Tell us who he is. You mentioned, you know, a little bit in the story we just listened to, but give us a picture of who this individual is.
Sure. So he's actually a fairly young guy. I mean, at the time of the stabbing, he was 30 years old. He came from Tennessee. My colleague Amanda Peacher, who we've heard on this show a few times, she kind of traced his background a little bit. He came from Tennessee, like I said, had prior convictions for felony assault, drug dealing, felony theft. And it just kind of seemed like he was drifting around before he came to Boise. He had been in Los Angeles for, I think, a couple years, if I remember right. And then a couple months before the stabbing, he was arrested in southern Utah for misdemeanor theft. That's really what we kind of know about him at this point.
And at this point, too, no trial yet, but there will be one, yes?
Yeah, and the reason why is because the judge has declared him mentally incapable of standing trial. So in Idaho, that means that Kinner can continue to be held in prison or jail until he's mentally fit enough to really understand the charges against him and to be able to defend himself appropriately.
So there's also another legal case, and this is with the little girl who was killed with her mom, correct?
Yeah, so the little girl's name is Ruya Kadir. Her mother, Beefy Two, has filed a lawsuit against not only Timmy Kinner, but the property manager of the Wiley Lane apartment complex, the owner of the complex, and the person who let Timmy Kinner stay there. I guess we didn't get into that, but the reason why he was at the complex was because that week he had been staying there. Someone had been, taken pity on him, saying, "Yes, you can stay here. I understand." And then at some point he got kicked out. I believe that was the Friday, the day before the stabbing, and then he came back, police say, for revenge.
And so do we know where this lawsuit is right now?
It's still ongoing. Okay. I mean, it was filed just a few months ago, so it's just working its way through the legal system right now.
And I really want to mention this because I think it's important. So for your story, you tried to interview quite a few people, but could not. Even an interview that you did could not be used. So explain to folks why that is the case.
Yeah, so a few months ago, because of the criminal case, the judge in that case for Timmy Kinner issued this thing called a gag order, which if you're not in the media, basically that means that anyone who is a witness or could have been a potential witness, so it's pretty broad, is forbidden from talking to the media about the case. And the reason why is because they don't want those types of stories with eyewitnesses to potentially, I don't know, color any jury that might come up for an inevitable trial, I guess.
I'm speaking with Boise State Public Radio reporter James Dawson about the one-year anniversary of the Boise stabbing, which happened on June 30th of last year. So Jimmy, within the refugee community, how, especially the people that were at the apartment complex, from what you've been able to gather over the last year, how have they been able to process this?
I think it really depends on who each individual, right? So, I mean, the person that I talked to, Abdullah, Al-Walid Abdullah, he seems to have processed it pretty well. I mean, he says, you know, he's still not scared about something similar happening in Boise. He thinks Boise is incredibly safe and says that he wants to stay here. Meanwhile, his wife, Fatima, she got a little better. It took her a couple months to not necessarily think that a similar attack might happen. But then really in the past couple weeks, she told me that she's been making sure to lock all the doors, kind of wants to install another lock on their front door in the apartment complex that they live. But she's kind of scared at every noise that she hears outside because her husband works nights, so she's there alone. And she just doesn't want that to happen to her.
So where are we in, or what's next, rather, with the case against Kinner? Because at this point, as you said, with him being declared kind of mentally incompetent, we don't know then when a trial could potentially happen?
Right now, it's scheduled for 2020, and we just kind of have these check-in periods every few weeks to every couple months just to try to see whether or not Timmy Kinner would be mentally capable of standing trial. And until that point, then we're just kind of in limbo.
I want to thank you for covering this. This is not an easy story to cover, and especially having to, as you, relive it as well. So thank you for doing that and giving us an update on that. The tragic events of last year's mass stabbing left our community shaken, but it also left many looking for ways to help. In the days following that attack last June 30th, the International Rescue Committee stepped in. They helped to organize temporary housing, cover medical bills, connect families and individuals with support services, just to name a few of the things that this organization did and is still doing. Across the Treasure Valley, organizations and businesses came together as well, fundraising through the IRC in a show of support. Joining us today to talk about how the community is moving forward is Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee, Julianne Donnelly-Zuhl. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
So I know you're able to talk in general terms, as we just talked about in our last segment. There is a gag order, so we cannot get into specifics. But in general, Julianne, can you give us an update on how the families who were affected, how are they doing?
Each one of them has their own path through their healing, but I am happy to say that each one of them has improved. And there's certainly been things in their life that pull them forward, whether it's kids going to school, kids starting soccer, new children, right? All of these things create their own rhythm and their own pull forward as life moves on.
And I can imagine that when this took place, we know that a lot of the people that were affected by this tragedy were new or newer to Boise. And as our James Dawson talked about, you know, people kind of move through things differently. So some people, you know, wanted to stay in Boise. Did for the most part, most people remain in Boise after this?
Most people stayed in Boise and continued. A few people moved to new school districts, new homes, right? Or new home schools.
Right.
But most people stayed.
Were you surprised by that? Because I think that we have an idea that when a tragedy like this happens, people want to just, you know, move and try to forget. But you're never going to forget, no matter where you are.
I mean, something that was really beautiful is that this response to the event really demonstrated the kinds of strengths that people build collectively before they come as refugees. So a lot of organic moments of support for one another. One of my favorite moments was people gathering for coffee every evening around the flower garden that mm-hmm. the firefighters planted. Nobody scripted that. It wasn't something where a counselor was staged, but it was incredibly healing to have something that brought a normal rhythm to day-to-day life again, and a lot of smiles and love and support mm-hmm. for whatever the feeling happened to be that particular day.
But even as you mentioned, when the firefighters planted the garden, because that happened organically as well.
Yes, absolutely. And was very meaningful both to the firefighters and to the families.
So I know the organization had been working on immigration applications in an effort to bring families, family members of people who were living in the complex at the time to Boise to offer support. So where are you in that process? And was it successful?
So the framework that allows people to come in an event like this is very subjective. So the different embassies that people's family members came through had very different responses. For one family, their siblings and their parents were able to come. For another family, the loved ones that they asked for still have not come.
Oh. That's got to be hard with the process as well.
Deeply painful.
Yeah. So let's talk about the fundraising, because this was something, as you said, things that happen just naturally and organically within our community. And one of them was our community wanting to reach out and help. And so the best way to do that was really through fundraising. So talk to me a little bit about how that all happened.
Yeah, it was a cascade of support, a cascade of emotion. It was really beautiful to see how many people leapt into service and how many people leapt to give both individually and collectively. We had two different music concerts that raised funds. The Micron employees did an employee fund drive that the employer then matched. It was really broad, and it was also really deep. There were some donors who got on our webpage and gave $5,000 just once, right? It was pretty intense.
Were you surprised by the outpouring of support financially from this community? I mean, because you work in this environment every day, so you see so many things. So what was this like just for you?
I think it felt totally right for the intensity of experience this was. I mean, everyone looked at these vulnerable children, and it went straight to the heart. So it's totally different from anything we've ever done before, but it was just right for this moment.
So do you know about how much has been raised so far?
Yeah, we raised a little bit over $445,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So where have the funds been dispersed then?
Sure. So we have been paying for things that the families have directed us that they want. Mm. So from the large public funeral that was held to the building of the grave site over Ruya's grave, to day-to-day expenses, rent, utilities, phones. One of the families bought a home with their own funds, not from our fund, immediately after it happened. And we have paid for that home to be remodeled to be accessible for that person's injuries.
I'm speaking with Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee, Julianne Donnelly-Zuhl, talking about moving forward from last June 30th with the stabbing that happened in Boise and what happened within the refugee community. So what about some of the families with the funds? Because I thought I had heard like some businesses had opened. I mean, have they been able to do things like that as well as part of this, you know, healing process, frankly, and being able to move forward?
They are each doing different things. There is one family that's opening a market. There's another family that's starting a commercial truck driving business. By and large, the funds for those businesses haven't come from our fund to this point. We are about to do a final distribution of what's left. But the ability to put together those businesses came before.
What's interesting, too, is when you think about, you know, as you said, having to pay things like utility, rent, you know, those necessities, is that even when tragedy strikes, the bills still have to be paid.
Yes, yes. All of these things that are the markers of kind of a normal life
right.
keep going.
So to have that, I would think from an emotional standpoint, that had to give some solace to this community, to just know that, okay, we can grieve and we don't have to worry.
We have the space that we need. Mm-hmm. Stuff is taken care of. There isn't pressure to get to be producing economically again.
Right.
Yeah.
So as we all know, when tragedy strikes, whether we talk about what happened here a year ago or we talk about other tragedies throughout our country, throughout the world, people do step up and people do give. But it also goes out of our collective consciousness after a time. Yet this community is still being affected. So are there things that people can do a year later?
Yeah. So first, I'd just say for everyone who knows the families, and there are many, from school teachers to soccer coaches, just to continue all of the love and support that has been showered on them. Working through trauma, it's kind of like being in open water. You can think, all right, things are going okay. I've got my rhythm. I've got my strokes are going in fine. And then another wave of water comes out of nowhere and just smacks you. The grief is like that. So I'd say just continue the care and support. In terms of financial support, we are dispersing the funds that we have gathered so far to the individual families. One thing that we wrapped up that could continue more is art therapy for the kids that are still at the apartment complex.
Oh.
We did support a counseling group to come in and do that for a couple of sessions. But if the community felt like supporting these kids more, we could certainly stand up another session.
And, you know, that is something I think sometimes we don't necessarily think about or is on our radar, is that we talk so much about children being resilient, and they are. However, they also need a place and a space and the right people, those professionals,
right,
to help them become resilient.
And we've learned by doing, right? We thought at the beginning, all right, we need to get everybody individual counselors. That wasn't really a cultural match necessarily. Mm. It didn't feel natural to some folks, and they opted out of it. We did the initial art therapy sessions, and we learned that we needed to really get parents' buy-in to both make sure that kids attended consistently and to be supporting the healing process intentionally, right? So getting those elements in place so that it works really, really well, we've learned by trying it and trying some things that didn't work as well as they could.
But the art therapy, for the most part, is what seems to be working with the kiddos.
Yes.
So getting some financial help for the kids when it comes to being able to continue this.
Yes, yes.
And how would people do that? Just contact your organization as they did last year?
Yes. If you would make a donation on our webpage, there's a place to write a note and indicate that it's for Wiley. We'll put it towards art therapy.
I want to thank you so much for coming in. So important to be talking about, I think, where people are right now, but also how we can continue to support this community within our larger community. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our guest today has been Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee, Julianne Donnelly-Zuhl. Up next, the Idaho Conservation League is claiming sewage plants in Idaho. They're struggling to keep our water clean. We're going to take a look at that. I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters.